Peacekeeping will be here with it, introducing highlights of a concert given by the Freiburg Baroque Orchestra at the Concerthaus in Freiburg, with music by Zelenka, a setting of the Lamentations. And the programme also includes Bach's Double Concerto in D minor for oboe and violin. That's the early music show at 1 o'clock. Now it's just gone 12 o'clock and it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Lucy Worsley is a historian who, in 2003, was appointed chief curator of historic royal palaces. Since then, she's made her passion public with books and television series that look at places and the way we live in them. For instance, The Secret History of Kensington Palace and If Walls Could Talk, An Intimate History of the Home. I think what makes your writing and indeed television series come alive, Lucy, is the way you do relate it to people and how they function within it, sometimes salaciously and naughtily, but not always.
Well, that's very nice of you to say so. I think that if that's true, it's partly because I'm used to working as a curator in museum environments. And at Kensington Palace, for example, we have these huge Georgian dresses on display. And I sometimes stand there and hear the visitors saying to each other, how on earth did they go to the loo in those dresses? So I want to answer the questions that people really want to ask and sometimes feel it's not appropriate.
And how do you answer that one?
Well, famously, these dresses were spread out over huge whalebone hoops, as Jonathan Swift said, large enough to hide a fine young man under there. And 18th century ladies weren't yet wearing knickers or drawers, hadn't been invented. So they had these devices like, they looked like a gravy jug, and you can just slip it in and nobody knows what you're doing. But you are supposed to get permission to leave the royal presence to use one of these things, even though it's very discreet. And this is not necessarily forthcoming. So once one of Queen Caroline's ladies says, can I go? The Queen says no. And a few minutes later, a humiliating puddle of urine creeps out from under her skirt.
Now, music, I think, has been quite important to you, not just as a listener, but as a practitioner. You have played music quite a bit.
Practitioner is too grand a word for it, but when I was little, I did have piano lessons for many years and played different instruments.
And the first piece, is that a result of those lessons?
Yes, absolutely. The first piece is by Eric Satie, and it's one of his gymnopédies. And this is a word he made up. He was always mocking the pretensions of Debussy and the other early 20th century composers. And this one I picked because I think that I played it in a piano competition in Nottingham when I would have been about 10 or 11. And I think this is the time that I won. I entered many times, did not always win. And I had a terrific teacher called Miss Beaumont who taught me this one.
Thank you.
I always imagined that a gymnopede was a large, white, rounded animal that sort of bumbled along through the undergrowth, a bit like a moomin.
I always thought it had something to do with gentle gymnastics. So.
Oh, gentle gymnastics,
but
that
was just my childhood interpretation. Gymnopede number 3 by Erik Satie and Kefalek playing the piano. There's something quite becalming about it.
Yes, it's. I remember that precision and consistency were the things that were hard about it, and not becoming sort of monotonous and repetitive. And it's got a lovely tune, hasn't it? And it was definitely number 3, not the better known number 1 that we had to play.
It's rather ironic, in a sense, that the thing that you steep yourself in, history and old buildings and how they act related to people, your success has been through the modern medium of television.
Yes, but for me, television's just a means to an end. It's continuation of the battle in a new area, really. Because what I think my job is to make history come alive and be exciting and interesting and entertaining for people, whether that's through exhibitions at work or through writing books or through appearing on the old TV.
Were you quite excited? Because it is an element of performance in doing something like that.
Yes, that's an interesting question. Is the person that you see on television the same person in real life? Well, yes and no. Often it's the person with the volume turned up a little bit. But there has to be something of themselves in there. It can't be totally an act, I guess, if you're appearing as yourself. And it's sometimes said that actors have difficulty being straightforward presenters because they don't know how to be themselves. But I had a lot of coaching and direction. And that was what was enjoyable about it, learning a new skill, being really challenged, trying to do it better.
Verdi next, Lucy Worsley. And this is something I think you sang. You played the last piece and I think you sang.
Yes, I sang this in the Pangbourne Choral Society. We've chosen to have this next party because it's just going to be such a contrast to Sati. And you do hear the choir singing in this. And I was a tenor. I like singing. I have naturally got quite a high soprano voice, which is totally untrained, so I find it much easier to sing as a tenor. And besides that, in any choir, it's the tenors who have the most fun, so I would always sit with the tenors.
Thank you.
final Liberame from the Verdi Requiem. Sharon Sweet was a soprano with the Ernst Senf Choir, the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. Rather fascinating that Verdi, who we associate so much with the opera house, should actually produce quite an operatic work, and yet somehow it seems to fit the rather dramatic text of the Latin Requiem.
Well, didn't Mozart do the same? His Requiem sounds a bit opera-ish. And if you're singing it, it's great because you know the words already. I just think that Henry VIII had a lot to answer for, and one of the things was that we didn't have this sort of melodramatic Catholic tradition in Britain.
When you were young, you actually had quite strong political and well, surprising convictions, didn't
you? You've read that, have you?
You're not the only one that does a bit of homework, you know.
It is true that I remember a debate when I converted the sixth form to communism, actually, through the strength and passion of my left-wing views. And I do remain quite a liberal sort of person, but a little bit more realistically so now, I feel.
Was this a surprise to your family, or were they of a similar inclination?
No, I would say that they were all mildly lefty themselves. My dad's worked in universities, my mother in the field of adult education.
So the fact that you actually subsequently became a historian, was that a surprise, really, given that you had an interest in politics? It's perhaps not surprising that history also would be rather fascinating.
Well, for me, it was a toss-up between history and English, because I've always liked words and writing, and those are the subjects that it seemed to me involved no effort. But it has to be said, my dad is a scientist, and he felt that scientists are the people who contribute most to society, and he was very keen that I went that way with my A-levels. And I did start biology, chemistry and maths, but I gave them up after a term with the support of my mom, who knew that my heart really lay in the arts.
Well, you must have been quite diligent as a pianist, because you got to grade 8, didn't you?
Yes, I did all my grades, and the next piece I've chosen, because it's one of the ones that I played in my grade 8 exam with great pleasure, actually. I loved this one, although, because my hands are actually quite small, Miss Beaumont always used to make me take the Mozart option on the list. And at the time, I slightly chafed against this. I wanted to play something more exciting, but you can vouch for it. They're not enormous. They've still got quite good reach from
it's
all the
bad,
training.
It's not bad, actually. Yes, the thumb to the small finger is reasonably
they're
good.
They're Mozart-shaped hands. Yes. The way that this particular slow movement works is that it begins with what sounds to me like a voice. It goes da, 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 and it does this beautiful singing bit. And then there's kind of a bit that's not quite as good, in my opinion. And the left hand has to keep playing the same thing over and over again. And I used to struggle with that because I found it less sympathetic. And she said, look, that's just the way it is. Great people can't be great the whole time. And when you're performing it, you've got to try to make the bits that you don't like as much sound as good as the other bits.
Sadly, we don't have your version to play. But we do have Mitsuko Ushida.
I know which I prefer to hear.
Thank you.
Halfway through, you said, Lucy, I didn't do that little tail in quite that way. And I wasn't sure if it was admonishing or admiring.
Well, the keys must have been played so amazingly gently to get the sound out. It was just really, really good. I was not that good. But I have to say, you know, lots of proper musical people would say Mozart a bit bland, a bit tinkly. But he would be my take-home all-time favourite composer, I have to say, because of the elegance of it, the simplicity of it, the effortlessness of it.
The piano sonata in B-flat major Kirkel 570, of which that was the second movement, the Adagio, played by Mitsuko Ushida. You are very fascinated with all the minutiae of what you discover. For example, in the book about houses and how we live in them, intimate walls and places. I wonder whether there's part of you that would quite like to almost write a novel.
Yes, I might want to do that one day, but I just feel that the secret of any good writing, fiction or non-fiction, is not necessarily in the nitty-gritty dirty detail, because you need all of that, and I love it, but what interests me about it is the way that if you add up all those little details, you can tell great overarching narratives about society or culture or medicine or hygiene. That's what I was trying to do in If Walls Could Talk. But sometimes, you know, just sometimes a little detail can open up a window into the past and you realise what a different place it was. So I'm not knocking constitutional and social history. They are important. It's just that we need social history too, I think.
Do you feel sometimes when you experience these conditions, which you've described, people all sleeping together. I mean, that the idea of having individual bedrooms...
Some people would think that was fun.
Well, yes. The idea of having individual bedrooms is quite recent, isn't it?
Yes, only 100 years old.
You could all sleep together, even in individual bedrooms. So, I mean, the fun is not necessarily got rid of. But I sort of thought the downside would rather triumph over the upside in terms of a sort of communal bedroom.
That's because you are a modern person. You're used to privacy. I suspect that you need it to live your daily life, but it was a luxury that medieval people just didn't have. They would have found it a bit weird to want to spend time by themselves, because you get security and safety and a bit of warmth if you're all sleeping together, even if it is noisy and smelly. So this urge to be by yourself comes with the rise of literacy and things like praying, reading, diary keeping. The Tudors, you know, the way the Tudors suddenly come into Technicolor is because we've got so many more voices speaking to us.
And what about things like the kitchen? Was that more like we might expect today, in as much as that it was a sort of quite a focal point?
Well, I think the kitchen is a room that's gone on a big circle, because the very centre, the focus of the medieval peasant's cottage was the half stone in the middle, focus, Latin for half. And then, as people became more genteel, more elegant, the kitchen and the sound and the smell of cooking gets pushed out into separate buildings in the 18th century. But then when we get to the 20th century and the whole domestic infrastructure collapses with the two world wars, there's a sense in which householders go back into their kitchens, reclaim them as family spaces. And now, I think in many people's homes, you'd say it was the kitchen that once again is the heart of it.
You could almost sleep in the kitchen. It's nice and warm.
You could do, and then that would be acting in a very good medieval way. And in fact, in my house, which is sort of open plan flat, you've got the kitchen and then it links straight through to the living room. And because I live in central London, you often find a friend sleeping on my sofa.
The next piece is Jerome Kern, Lucy Worsley. And I think, again, this is something that you have actually sung yourself.
Yes. This song combines two great loves of mine. It's all about history, long ago and far away. And a famous antiquity gets mentioned in it, which is Aladdin's lamp. And it's also a lovely, jazzy, easy-listening kind of song. And I remember singing this at my leaving party from English Heritage when I left there. But more recently, I got into a mess with this because I'm a member of the Society of Antiquaries. It sounds like it's out of Trollope, but it's a wonderful, august organisation. And they had a sort of dining club, and it met at the Athenaeum. And there's a misunderstanding. They said, will you come to our dining club, but you'll have to sing for your supper.
So you thought you were going to give a talk or something?
No, I thought they meant literally sing for your supper. So I learnt my song and I prepared it, and then I turned up and they said, oh, actually, we were expecting you to tell a few anecdotes. It was a wonderful evening because all the members bring in an antiquity of their own, including including things like one gentleman had quite a dangerous-looking spear that he'd brought with him on the tube that seemed a bit dodgy. And it was sort of, guess what it is? All the antiquarians explored each other's anecdotes.
So did you just get up and sing then?
Yeah.
And did it go down well?
It went down quite well, I would say, and well enough so that when I went to another of these clubs that they had on another occasion, they said, will you sing your song? We'd like to hear it as well. So I fought to get out of it. I'd said, only if Brian Dix, who's a very celebrated archaeologist, sings the minutes of the last meeting, thinking he'll never do that. But he did. He got up and he sang the minutes of the last meeting in a sort of plain song way. So I sang my song again. I think you might have thought that was a bit lowbrow. Did you enjoy it?
Oh, no, I love a good tune.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't. It doesn't matter whether it's low or highbrow. I mean, if it's a good tune, it's a good tune. It defies categorisation.
I have to tell the listeners that Michael wasn't conducting along to that one like he did the previous ones.
No, but I was savouring it. Long Ago and Far Away, Jerome Kern, sung by Joe Stafford. Since you're giving away my private secrets, you had a visitor to Hampton Court, didn't you, once? Rather famous film star?
Oh, not Johnny Depp. Everybody always asks me about Johnny Depp.
People are fascinated by Johnny Depp.
Well, he was making a film at Hampton Court. I think it was the Libertine. And his manager phoned up and said, would you stay late tonight in order to give Johnny a private tour of the palace? And I was supposed to be going out to a party that night with my lovely boyfriend. So okay then. So I phoned up Mark and I said, sorry, standing you up tonight. Going out with Johnny Depp instead. And he wasn't very happy about that. Put the phone down. And then we waited and waited, got to 8 o'clock. And the manager phoned again. He said, awfully sorry, Johnny's tired. He's gone home. So I thought, right, I'm off to that party then. And when I got there, everybody in the room looked at me and said, we thought you were out with Johnny Depp. So obviously it was quite good for Mark to have been stood up by Johnny Depp, and he told everybody about it.
I think you should have said you stood him up. More keyboard music now by, and this is one of the most wonderful pieces, The Well-Tempered Clavier by Bach. Now, I think we had an example of a competition or an exam where you won. This was one, sadly, where you failed.
This is the end of my career as a good pupil, because that is what I was, a good pupil and not a naturally gifted musician. I'm just quite good at improving within my own capacity, and it reached its limits when I did my diploma exam, which was a big deal for me then, because I had to go up from my school in Newbury and I had to make my way by the train and the tube all the way to the Trinity School of Music, which was off Oxford Street. So it was a very trying, daunting experience, and this was one of the pieces that I played. And then a few weeks later, the results came back. No, you failed. And it was, I have to say, at that point when I was 18, it was probably one of the worst days of my life so far, because not only had I failed my diploma, on the very same day, Labour lost the election. It was John Major's unexpected success. And the pupils lost to the teachers in the annual pupils versus teachers general knowledge quiz. So being so competitive and all that, and being quite lefty, that was a really dark day.
Thank you.
although the fugue sounds so much more complex, it was actually the prelude where I fell apart, and it was nerves and the exposed, quite simple but exposed, way you have to hold it all together.
Do you relate to the kind of sheer organisational beauty of the music, the way the mind and the heart are married to such a wonderful degree?
Oh, yes, it's like a puzzle, isn't it? And you can spot the motif coming back and back again.
Because, you know, some people think of Bach as being cerebral. And, of course, there is a degree of cerebral thinking that goes into it, but it's so much more than that.
Yes, you're quite right. It's not just Hannibal Lecter playing it by himself and thinking his his weird cerebral thoughts.
The Bach Prelude and Fugue in C-sharp major from the Well-Tempered Clavier Book 1 was played by Angela Hewitt. Although, Lucy Worsley, you slightly played down your musicality, you seem to have actually performed everything in the programme at some point or another.
Well, that's why I chose the things, because I'd played them all myself.
And was this? Did you go to the tenor sax after, in frustration at failing your grade 8?
No. I started out with the piano, and then I wanted an instrument that I could play with other people. So I picked up the clarinet so I could play it in orchestras and so on. And then I wanted something else that was different and a bit more unusual. And I remember it was a toss-up between the cello and the tenor saxophone, both of which were going to be big and inconvenient and heavy, but would be different. And I chose the tenor saxophone because I thought I'd have a head start because of already knowing how to blow. But actually, it was a bit too big for me to carry about to really ever get comfortable with it. But the great advantage was being able to play in big bands. And I love big band music. And every New Year's Day, we go along to the Barbican where they have the Glenn Miller Band and all the old guys in their American Army uniforms.
It requires quite a lot of breath. The one time I tried to play a saxophone, I was completely defeated by trying to get enough breath through that mouthpiece.
Yeah, I think I was overambitious in choosing the tenor as well. I should have stuck to the alto. But one of the great advantages is the solo in Little Brown Jug, where you stand up and you do your thing.
We'll be right back.
it was very hard to choose just one Glemmler song.
So you went from singing tenor to playing tenor.
Oh, I guess I did, yes, yeah.
Little Brown Jug, the Glemmler Band. Little Brown Jug by Joseph Winner, arranged by Bill Finnegan. You were talking about your hands. Indeed, we were looking at them just now. And Liszt would seem a bit of a challenge from that point of view.
Yes, well, this is my consolation for failing my final diploma exam. I think I spent about a year trying to learn to play this piece with total unsuccess, but it's always seemed like that final peak in the mountain range that you never scale that you would have liked to have done.
Tell me about this music. What do you feel about it? What's it saying? What's its strength? I mean, if we heard, for example, we had heard about that counterpoint in the Bach fugue, and we talked about the simplicity and elegance in Mozart. What is it about Liszt, do you think, that...
Well, this one is hugely luscious and romantic, and you kind of drown in the beauty of it all. And it's a total contrast to the Bach and the Mozart that I'd been playing so seriously and with such discipline for my studies for...
So you're letting your hair down?
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
So it's the Année de Pèlerinage, second year in Italy, Sonnet 104 of Petrarch, played here by George Bollet.
Thank you.
After the Mozart and the Bach, it's extraordinary how sort of impulsive, improvisatory, well, romantic, really, that music sounds, doesn't it?
Yes, but it is all written down. And I have to say, one of the disadvantages of having taken piano lessons for so many years is a complete failure to improvise oneself.
Well, that means you're probably a better sight reader than me, because I did everything by ear.
Oh, okay.
And I think people divide rather into those two things.
Oh.
If we were disciplined creatures, or if I was a disciplined creature, I would have done both.
But I think that's probably the difference between a true musician and me.
Oh, I wouldn't put it like that. Anyway, we heard Georges Bollet there playing the Sonnet 104 of Petrarch from the Année de Pèlerinage, second year, Italy, by Liszt. We're going to finish Lucy Worsley with, I think, probably the best musical, apart from Rodgers and Hammerstein, at least the one musical that really managed, like Gershwin, since Gershwin, to marry a kind of element of classical and popular music.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, actually, because I thought I was maybe pushing it with these 20th century sort of show tunes. We've had Jerome Kern, we've had Glenn Miller, but I have heard it said that modern pop music begins in this song tonight of West Side Story, because you can see connections back to Verdi here with the formal setup, the different voices coming in, and yet it's got a super, super pop tune, hasn't it?
And, of course, it's Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, it is, yes, yeah.
And I think you think we're far more sniffy than we really are. We're prepared to get down and dirty, don't worry. With Maria, as it happens on this occasion.
The Jets are gonna have their day tonight. The Sharks are gonna have their way. The Puerto Ricans rumble, fair fight. But if they start a rumble, we'll rumble them right. We're gonna hand them a surprise tonight. We're gonna cut them down to size tonight. We said okay, no rumpus, no tricks. But just in case they jump us, we're ready to miss tonight. We're gonna rock it tonight. We're gonna jazz it up and have us a ball. They're gonna get it tonight. The more they turn it on, the harder they fall. Well, they began it. Well, they began it. And we're the ones to stop them once and for all tonight.
Anita's gonna get her kicks tonight. We'll have her private little mix tonight. He'll walk in hot and tired, so what? Don't matter if he's tired, as long as he's hot.
Tonight, tonight won't be just any night. Tonight there will be no morning star. Tonight, tonight I'll see my love tonight, and for us stars will stop where they are. Today the minutes seem like hours, the hours go so slowly, and still the sky is bright. Oh, moon, grow bright and make this endless day, endless night.
We're counting on you to be there tonight. When Diesel wins it fair and square tonight. That Puerto Rican punk will go down. And when he's hollered uncle, we'll tear up the town.
Tonight, tonight won't be just any night.
Baby, how it goes, so stay behind.
It was a good analogy you made, actually. I hadn't thought of it like that. The Verdi using opera on a sacred text. And there, in a way, Bernstein was taking pop music and treating it operatically, especially where he combines the Jets and the Sharks with the Tonight tune on top.
Yes, absolutely. You could imagine it being staged in a, I want to say in a church or but you know what I mean, people standing up and coming down when it's their bit. And when I played it, I was tooting away, struggling with the syncopation on my clarinet. And it was so romantic because our Tony and our Maria fell in love and started dating in real life.
We heard Larry Kurt, who was Tony, Carol Lawrence, Maria, and Chita Rivera and Mickey Kalin from the original Broadway cast recording conducted by Max Goberman in the Tonight reprise with the quintet from West Side Story by Bernstein. Words, of course, by Sondheim, and very amusingly, I think he gets terribly irritated that he's better known for that in some ways than all his own musicals, because it is a kind of masterpiece, West Side Story. Well, thank you very much, Lucy Worsley. Are you working on a new series or a new book, or are you simply at your desk in Kensington Palace?
Well, we're chained to our desks at Kensington Palace at the moment. There's a lot of hoarding up. You'll see we've got building works going on. We've got a grand reopening next spring.
And are you writing?
No, I'm not at the moment. I'm officially taking a break, having been overproductive for a little while.
Well, thank you for being overproductive on our behalf today.
That's my very great pleasure.
Lucy Worsley was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the former physician, philosopher, writer and cultural critic, Dr. Raymond Tallis. Private Passions is a classic arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall.
Live piano music from London's Wigmore Hall on BBC Radio 3 tomorrow night. You can hear Marc-André Amelin with a recital of music spanning almost two centuries of virtuoso keyboard writing. Each of the four works by Haydn, Stockhausen, Villa-Lobos and Liszt was written with a specific piano virtuoso in mind. And earlier in the day, another great concert pianist gives a recital at Wigmore Hall. Alexander Melnikov plays an all Brahms programme broadcast live in the Radio 3 lunchtime concert. Two live concerts of piano music from London's Wigmore Hall. On Monday on BBC Radio 3 at 1 o'clock and 7:30.
Well, the time today is 1 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's time now for the news with David Cornett.
Heavy snow is causing disruption to travel across much of Britain. Up to 6 inches of snow fell in some areas overnight, and on the M40, up to 100 vehicles were left stranded. The Met Office has warned drivers to expect treacherous conditions today as ice forms on the roads. A third of flights due to leave Heathrow Airport today have been cancelled, and some train services in southern England have been disrupted. The Foreign Secretary, William Hague, has accused Russia and China of encouraging further bloodshed in Syria after they vetoed a UN Security Council resolution condemning the Assad regime. Russia said it could not support measures calling for the departure of President Assad. Mr. Hague said both countries had taken up an indefensible position. More than 40 supporters of the former Libyan dictator Colonel Gaddafi have gone on trial in the eastern city of Benghazi. The judge overseeing proceedings said it was the first trial of people accused of attempting to crush the uprising, which began last year. At least 7 people have been killed in a bomb attack in southern Afghanistan. Most of the dead are police officers, although one child was also killed. The explosives were hidden inside a vehicle which entered a police car park close to the Kandahar City Police headquarters. The Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, has defended the government's plans to push through major changes to the health service in England at a time when the NHS is being asked to save billions of pounds. The Labour leader Ed Miliband has called on health professionals and politicians to work together to prevent what he called a leap into the dark for the NHS. The former Cuban president Fidel Castro has made a rare public appearance to launch his memoirs. The book Guerrilla of Time relates his childhood and rise to power in the Cuban Revolution. Fidel Castro, who's 85, hadn't been seen in public since April last year. And the weather, a very cold day, especially in eastern England. Tonight, outbreaks of rain will affect northwest England, the Midlands and southeast England. BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one.
Read by David Cornett. Well, I'm Jill Anderson. Very good afternoon to you. Our Sunday concert at 2 o'clock is a recital of string quartets by Beethoven, played by the Belcher Quartet. We'll be hearing the Quartet in G, Opus 18, number 2, the Razumovsky Quartet in E minor, Opus 59, number 2, and the Quartet in C sharp minor, Opus 131. That's at 2 o'clock. But now it's time for the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show and highlights today from a concert given in Freiburg. This is the southernmost city of Germany, the home of one of the country's oldest universities and dominated by a Gothic cathedral that dates back to the 1200s. So there was some controversy when the ultra-modern concert house with its glass front and jagged style roof opened its doors for business back in the mid-1990s. Since then, it's played host to concerts of all kinds, and today's performance is given by one of Germany's most acclaimed ensembles, the Freiburg Baroque Orchestra, who've been at the top of their game for over 20 years, touring to just about every corner of the globe with their sparkling interpretations of music from the 18th century. Their programme includes a setting of the Lamentations of Jeremiah by the Prague-born composer Jan Dismas Zelenka, which features the voice of the Norwegian baritone Johannes Weiser, and music by Johann Gottlieb Goldberg, a pupil of J.S. Bach. And we'll also hear three works by Bach himself, beginning with his Fantasy in C minor. This was originally written as a prelude and fugue for solo organ, and you can still hear much of that sustained organ-like texture in this version for orchestra. Bach's Fantasy in C minor, played by the Freiburg Baroque Orchestra, a highlight from their concert recorded for us by the European Broadcasting Union at the Freiburg Concert House. They're joined next by the singer Johannes Weiser for the first of the two vocal works we'll hear. And it's another piece by Bach, the first movement from